at macfound.org.
Good morning. Welcome to Radioactivity. I'm Rob Loray. Coming up today, we're going to hear Florida This Week from this past Friday night, a discussion about state and local politics. And then later on in this hour, we'll hear an interview that Dr. Martin Luther King did about 5 months before he was assassinated. He talks a lot about the Vietnam War, but he also talks a lot about domestic policy, too. We'll hear that in just a few minutes. First, two listener comments about last Friday's program. Last Friday, we had an interview with Colonel Larry Wilkerson about the potential for war between the U.S. and Iran. And also on that show, we talked about the government shutdown. Here's what two listeners had to say.
About the government shutdown. I heard somebody the other day on the news, a TSA person, explaining how badly they felt and sort of a certain shame to have to go to a local food bank. It made me so angry because that person, the word shame should have never have come out of their mouth. The one who should feel shame is the shameless one, as we know, that occupies the White House. And he's got a stone heart. He is not going to do it on his own. He's banking, I think, on the Democrats folding because they have a heart comparatively. So anyway, I am just hoping some of the people in power can really rub it in his face, so to speak, by taking care of the people in this country who are working for nothing.
Thank you for your interview with Colonel Wilkerson today. He's right about the United States administration, with Trump and Bolton leading the way, are after regime change in Iran. And we know from listening to Democracy Now! This morning that they're also after regime change in Venezuela. So I would just say we have to be very careful and watch this administration very carefully to make sure they don't start a war with Iran or Venezuela. Iran has completed their end of the nuclear deal. They've submitted to inspections. There's 24-hour surveillance of their nuclear facilities, and they still are submitting to that. We could only hope to get such a good deal with North Korea, but I do favor diplomacy with North Korea as well.
We have some listener comments that came in after last Friday's Radioactivity program. Well, right now we're going to hear Florida This Week from this past Friday night. It's a program that airs originally on the PBS station WEDU here in Tampa. It's a discussion about state and local politics. As we listen to this program, too, please email the studio and give us your thoughts about the topics we're going to discuss. The email address here in the studio is dj@wmnf.org. Here is Florida This Week. Coming up next, there's another effort to get guns on college campuses. A new poll says Florida should have open primary elections. Florida's facing another teacher shortage, and our U.S. senators split on the question of Russian sanctions. Political insights next on Florida This Week. Welcome back. This week our panelists are William March is an independent journalist. Gal Fields is the founder of Fields & Company and a Republican. Rita Ferrandino is the CEO and founder of ARC Capital and a Democrat. And Paula Dockery is a columnist and former state legislator and is currently not affiliated with any political party. Well, it's nice to see you guys.
Good to be here.
Well, for the fourth time in 5 years, there's a move in the state legislature to allow some college and university students, to carry guns on campus. This time, freshman Republican Anthony Sabatini of Lake County is the latest to try. Sabatini says concealed weapons permit holders should be treated the same way on a college campus as they are anyplace else. He says now that armed personnel are being trained to be on K-12 campuses, good people on college campuses should be armed to prevent the next mass shooter. If state lawmakers were to approve Sabatini's House Bill 6007, Florida would join 12 other states that allow citizens to carry firearms on campus. Arkansas, Colorado, Georgia, Idaho, Kansas, Minnesota, Mississippi, Oregon, Texas, Tennessee, Utah, and Wisconsin.
So, Gal, is this a good move?
I don't think so.
Why not?
I think it's a situation where we really need to allow the universities to make the decision how they want to handle it if we go that far. But providing security on the campuses is really a responsibility they should have and have control of. And then if the worst case scenario happens and law enforcement shows up, how do they know who's the active shooter or somebody who started out with a gun on their person? They're not linked into the communication system. They have no way of letting law enforcement know what they're doing. And it becomes a situation where we think we're providing a safer environment, and we're really not. You don't know how many guns are on the campus. You don't know where they are. And they could become the first victim, and someone takes their gun from them and uses it to begin starting some violence. And so I just think it's the wrong approach. It should be similar to what the schools are doing now, working with the state, where they train people, connect it to law enforcement, and they're able to do it in an organized fashion. Universities should have the same freedom to do that.
Paula, this is a legislation being proposed by a freshman. You've been there. You've been in both houses in Tallahassee. Do freshmen have much luck with legislation?
If they're in the majority party.
Do they?
Yeah. But when I was at the end of my term in office, when I was chairing the Criminal Justice Committee, this bill came up in my committee, and it wasn't going to make it through. And I told the sponsor of the bill it wasn't going to make it through. But even if we had passed it through, John Thrasher, who was the rules chairman, was adamantly opposed to this. And he gave me a really great rationale. And now he's the president at Florida State University, and all of the university presidents feel like this is a decision that should be made campus by campus. And so if the bill was to say that it was up to each individual campus to decide, I could support that. But I just don't think it's a great idea. I think it's a terrible idea, in fact. And the rationale of Parkland, oh, this is what we're doing because of Parkland, this works against their argument for this, because the person who committed the crime in Parkland was a fellow student or a former fellow student.
Right. And what's your sense of this legislature? You mentioned it's come up before.
It keeps coming up.
So what's your sense of this legislature? Is it more pro NRA or less? And what's your sense of the new Senate president and the new Speaker of the House?
I don't know that much about the new Speaker of the House. The new Senate president is a great guy. The Senate is probably where it'll end. Usually is the Senate where it ends, because the House generally is more pro-NRA. But NRA, it doesn't seem to have the shine and gleam that it did prior to the Parkland tragedy. Yeah. And also what's going on nationally with the NRA and their ties to Russia.
And we're coming up on February 14th. We're going to have the anniversary of Parkland, so there's going to be a lot of memorials about Parkland. But Rita, the NRA says the only thing that stops a bad guy with a gun is a good guy with a gun, which is the rationale for putting armed guards in schools, and it's now this rationale for putting allowing people who have concealed weapons permits to carry guns on campus.
Well, let me just say that I think that I am a parent of a college sophomore, and I know the mindset of 19-year-olds who may be out partying, and there's no way as a parent I am supporting having open access to guns on college campuses. I will also say that universities have very strong protocols and safety security systems, and anything that goes wrong, I as a parent or when I'm there teaching, I get notifications and alerts. They've got protocols in place. This is completely unnecessary. I want the state legislature to be worrying about students graduating from college campuses, not how they're able to carry guns. And I think that's the thing that I want to mention.
Well, Wendy Sabatini, this freshman legislator, says gun-free zones are bad. And that's what he's trying to get away from, is gun-free zones. He calls universities gun-free zones. I think it's fair to say even the legislature is a gun-free zone.
Yes, yeah. The legislature is perfectly happy for the legislature itself to be a gun-free zone. And a lot of people have called this bill out over the years that it's come up over and over again, like Paula said, have called it hypocritical for that reason. But I want to follow up on something else Paula said. The NRA's lost a little bit of its shine. There's been some bitter division that cropped up over between the NRA and its normal constituency, which is the Republicans, over the bill passed in the aftermath of the Parkland shooting, the high school shooting. And Bill Galvano is one of the ones that the NRA has gone after because of large contribution.
He's the new Senate president.
Bill Galvano, the new Senate president. And but at the same time, there are still people in the legislature who will carry the NRA's water. In addition to this bill we're talking about, another, I think, freshman, Mike Hill from Pensacola, has introduced a bill to repeal parts of the Parkland follow-up legislation that the NRA didn't like, raising the age to 21 to buy a rifle. But I suspect, like Paula said, every year this has come up, and every year some strategic key person in the Senate, a judiciary chairman like Diaz de la Portilla, has stopped it. And presumably that will happen again, though one can't be certain.
You know, I've heard the incoming Speaker of the House, Oliva, being described as more conservative than Corcoran the last 2 years. But I'm wondering if Galvano may be more moderate or middle of the road as a Senate president. Is anybody hearing anything about where Galvano may take the Florida Senate?
Galvano is conservative on some issues and more moderate on others, but I would not in any way, shape, or form say he's not conservative. He is.
Okay. Well, an election reform group recently conducted a survey of Florida voters and found strong support for open primaries. Right now, participation in primary elections is limited to registered members of the two major political parties. Independents, third-party members, and NPAs are not allowed to vote in primary elections. Earlier this month, a group called Open Primaries took a survey of registered voters here in Florida and found widespread opposition to the current primary system. 69% of Floridians believe the state's current closed primary system is unfair to the growing number of the state's independent voters, now 27% of Florida's electorate. 70% of Floridians, including supermajorities of Republican, Democrat, and independent voters, want the Republican and Democratic parties to open their 2020 presidential primaries to independents. And 71% of Florida voters believe that if the political parties want to keep the closed primaries, then the party should pay for them. Otherwise, taxpayer-funded elections should be open to all voters.
So, Paula, you're the perfect person to ask. What do you think? Should we have open primaries?
Yeah. Well, the way around it right now is several weeks before every election, I can go in and pick a party and switch to that, wait for my new ID card, go in and vote in that primary. Then when the election's over, go back in. Well, that's kind of a ridiculous waste of time for me and the supervisor of elections office. But I am going to vote one way or the other in a primary. A lot of NPAs don't take the trouble to go through all of that. So, you know, why would you want to eliminate 30% of the registered voters in the state of Florida and not have them involved in the primary? Parties are against it because they lose a little control. They can't really figure out who these NPAs are and what they want. But keep this in mind. The problem in our political system, this is my opinion, but the problem in our political system is extremists get elected by their base party base. So if you were to, and that's because the NPAs aren't acting as a moderating force, but I think the majority of Americans and Floridians are somewhere in the middle, and they don't really have their voices heard in the general because they've already been excluded from the primaries when they chose candidates that were too far to either the right or the left for them.
Rita, as a Democrat, what do you think? What do you think about open primaries?
I have to say I'm in support of it.
Yeah.
Because I am just fed up with the fact that we've got extremes on either side of the aisle, and I really want to see us get back to governing from a more moderate, reasonable perspective. And I think that this issue around open primaries is really one of the only ways we can figure out to structurally realign to get back to more of a moderate position.
This group makes a point too, Gal, that why should taxpayers pay for essentially private organizations like the Democratic Party or the Republican Party vote? The taxpayers fund these elections, but only Democrats and Republicans are allowed to vote in primaries.
Sounds like you're making a very reasoned argument for open primaries.
What do you think about it? Is it a good idea?
I think it is a good idea. And when we go back to what has really brought this about, the reason NPA is the fastest growing party is because people are tired of the behavior of what's going on the extreme. They're tired of seeing Democrats and Republicans treat each other as enemy combatants rather than citizens of the same country with maybe some differences of opinion. Mm-hmm. That's the only thing that's going to change it, is if they now have to run an election that appeals to everyone. In just this last election cycle, we saw someone in Polk County monkey with the system to close the primary so that he had a better chance to win. He went to a former employee that looked up to him as a father figure, and what we ended up with was essentially an open primary, but it had to be done in the general election, and you saw a different campaign, and you got a different result than what you would have had there been a closed primary. But those types of abuses and the behavior on the extremes is what's driving this, and what'll change it faster is to do the open primary.
Wendy, I talked with this group, Open Primaries, earlier this week, and they say they want the parties themselves to change the rules. Just knowing the party structures here in Florida, because you cover politics closely, one idea is to have the parties themselves change the rules. The other idea is to have an issue on the ballot and leave it up to Florida voters to see if they would pass an amendment requiring open primaries.
Well, Rob, everybody else at this table has done a great job of stating the arguments in favor of this, but the devil's in the details. How do you do it? There are lots of different ways. There are four or five different systems for running primaries, from closed to partially open to partially closed to one system allows the party itself to declare prior to the election whether its primary will be open to independent voters or not. Other systems allow voters to go in and choose that day at the polls which primary they want to vote in. But the parties also make an argument that shouldn't be overlooked. It's basically a freedom of association argument. They say, we're not the government. We're a private organization. We're a political party. If you want to help determine our nominee, join our party. Mm-hmm. People say they're fed up with parties, but the parties are nothing more than the people who are in them.
This
group, if you don't like the party, join it and change it.
This group, Open Primary, says, then why are taxpayers paying for these private elections?
Because it's a function of how we've decided to choose our office holders. We could decide to choose them in a different way, and you still wouldn't necessarily be able to vote in whichever primary you wanted to. Mm-hmm. You still might have to decide which primary you wanted to vote in. You wouldn't be able to vote in both under any system that I know of. You're still going to be excluding some voters from some contests under any system that's currently used in the country right now.
All right. Well, once again, this year, Florida is facing a teacher shortage.
The State Department of Education numbers for this school year are out, and they show that nearly 3,300 teacher vacancies exist across the state. The shortage is especially acute in English, reading, math, and science and technical education. A new WalletHub survey finds Florida ranks near the bottom, number 47 among all 50 states in the District of Columbia when it comes to the best states for teachers. That study looked at teachers' income growth potential, pupil-teacher ratio, and teacher safety.
So, Rita, this has been happening the last several years. Why are we having teacher shortages here in Florida?
Well, first of all, I should disclose that I am faculty at the University of Pennsylvania's Graduate School of Education, so I can speak with authority on this. This is a national crisis. It is not new. It has been, we have seen the pattern. Here in Florida, your viewers need to know that when school started, we had 4,000 classrooms in the state of Florida that did not have teachers to teach
That's
in them.
Outrageous.
And this January, in Florida, we still had 2,200 classrooms with no teachers. Mm-hmm. And this January, nationally, we have seen more teachers exit teaching in the middle of the year than in the history of our country.
So why is that?
It's because teachers have very low pay. teachers have extreme cases of students in their classrooms, the lack of mental health and counseling that needs to go on in their classrooms has been diminished. The list goes on and on of the demands of teachers, and I think we need to have a really strong look. The state legislature really has to do some things to start correcting this. Last year, they took some actions to incentivize new teachers to be placed into the classroom. It was not well thought out, and it had a disincentivizing effect that they didn't count on. So let's go back to the drawing board. We can fix this as a community, and at the moment, we're not.
And now we've got Richard Corcoran as the education commissioner here in the state of Florida.
Which isn't too likely to help. I mean, you said, why is this happening, Rob? The reasons are no big mystery. They're paid less than almost any other state in the nation, and the legislature seems to enjoy kicking them around. That's really all it comes down to, and that's all there is to it. Corcoran in the legislature was a devotee of what is called by the movement educational choice. What it basically amounts to is diverting money from traditional public schools into charter schools, which are a form of public schools, and into private school tuition vouchers. And he's likely to push that philosophy even more as education commissioner. Every few months you see another story on where Florida ranks in teacher pay. We are generally in the mid-40s.
Near
the bottom. In teacher pay. If you happen to live in North Florida and you can get a job across the state line, you'll make more in Georgia, for heaven's sake. Mm-hmm.
So, Gal, I know in Polk County is facing a maintenance and a building budget shortage for its schools in Polk County. There are many counties like Polk County available. I mean, that are experiencing that kind of problem. So you've got disenchanted teachers saying they don't get paid enough, and then you've got the strains on the budget for the school system. How do we get out of this?
Well, let me add something to the list you started, the disrespect that teachers feel as a profession that they receive from many hands and on many fronts. One of the things that we're going to have to do is get serious about treating public education as the front line of our workforce development in America. If we take that seriously, then the investments in the facilities and in the people who deliver the education to the children, and making sure that our testing requirements for teacher certification make sense, because that is one of the other challenges. People who want to get into the profession, they're running into challenges with the certification process. So you've got a whole mix of things. And in my view, my wife serves on the school board in Polk County, and this is a common conversation we have, is we don't place the value on educating next generation of workforce, not only for their own needs, but for what it's going to do for the country and for America's employers.
Mm-hmm. We've got to think of it as a national security issue.
Yes.
And again, when you've got 4,000 classrooms at the start of school with no teachers in it, crisis.
Yes.
So, Paula.
Amen to what everybody said. And it is a matter of teachers having very low morale, not being treated with respect. It is pay, but it's also the fact that they're having to teach to the test. It's that they have no ability to use any kind of innovation. They're very hamstrung. So there's a lot of problems. It's our education policy, and it's the legislature's fault for what we're seeing in the classrooms.
Since the era of Jeb Bush, we've seen all these kind of changes to the Florida school system, and I think former Governor Bush promised us that we would end up with a better education system overall. So we're about 20 years out from that. Not quite. Do we have a better education system overall?
No, we do not. And this move towards privatizing education is not in the best interest of our students or our
school,
teachers.
But the fans of school choice say, look, if my local public school is bad, I want to take my kid out.
But it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. We've taken away the tools. We've taken away the funding. We've taken away their ability to be innovative. And then we say, but they can do that on the other side. So we have to, it's an uneven playing field, and we need to level that playing field and treat them
the
same.
And the people that are going to these other schools that don't have any level of accountability, they don't have certifications for their teachers, they're not we're not being able to hold any of them accountable for the use of our tax dollars. The problems are serious.
Okay.
Yeah, very little accountability on the other side.
Well, finally, Florida's two Republican U.S. senators split this week on whether to block President Trump's plan to lift sanctions on a Russian oligarch described in news reports as an ally of Vladimir Putin. Senator Marco Rubio joined 10 Republicans to break ranks and vote with Democrats to reject the Trump administration's proposal to ease sanctions on the companies of Russian billionaire Oleg Deripaska. They were trying to send a message to Russia to stop interfering in U.S. elections. However, the effort fell three senators short of the 60 needed to end debate and hold a vote on the resolution. Newly minted Florida Senator Rick Scott joined a majority of his GOP colleagues to back the president. The vote in the Senate means that the Trump administration will be able to lift the Russia sanctions. Deripaska is also known as Putin's favorite industrialist, who had loaned $10 million to Trump's now jailed former campaign manager, Paul Manafort.
All right, Wendy, was it Marco Rubio voting in the public interest or Rick Scott voting in the public interest? Are the sanctions good for America or are they bad for America?
Well, this story is insane. I barely even know where to start. Okay, Rubio voted to force the sanctions to stay in place, and Scott voted with the Trump administration to allow them to be lifted. The sanctions were put in place partly because of Deripaska's involvement in what, in basically organized crime, at a high level organized crime in Russia, not so much because of any tie between him and interference in the American elections. Not at the time that the sanctions were put in place in April, but since then, those links have started to be made, and now we have the Belarusian sex trainer, which is a woman who claims that she has recordings of Deripaska talking about the elections with Americans. And we have reports about Deripaska's business dealings with Paul Manafort at the same time that Manafort was volunteering to be chairman of the Trump campaign.
And on that note, stay tuned for more.
And Rob, I just want to say there is no way that Rick Scott can justify his vote on this.
All right. Before we go, what's your other big story? Gal Fields.
In following the decision by the Lakeland City Commission to remove the monument from Munn Park and to help with some of the healing in the community and bridging the divide, Lakeland Chamber is sponsoring, at the request of the mayor, along his table. So we're bringing that initiative to the Lakeland community following on what other communities have done.
All right. And a peaceful resolution?
Yes, sir.
All right. Paula?
Governor DeSantis today suspended Palm Beach County Supervisor of Elections, Susan Bucher. It may be that there was good cause for that, but it's starting to seem a little suspicious that so many Democratic elected officials are being suspended by the new Republican governor. So I think we need to keep our eye on these moves.
All right. Rita, your other big story?
Story of the week is definitely the Russian sex tapes.
That Wendy brought up. Okay, we got to hear more about that. And here we're doing a Florida show. Wendy, your other big story?
Okay, I'm going to go with Cuba, even though it's speculative. The Trump administration may, for the first time since the law was passed in the 90s, allow lawsuits by people in America who claim their property was confiscated when Castro took over Cuba. And there are a lot of people in Florida and a lot of people in Tampa who would love to file such lawsuits, but opponents, critics say that it would cause chaos for American companies who are now starting to do business in Cuba, who would find themselves unable to use port facilities and things that they normally use.
All right, we'll have to pay attention to that. Thank you all. It's great to see you.
You're welcome.
And thanks for watching Florida This Week. Your comments are always welcome. Please write us at ftw@wedu.org.
Well, that was Florida This Week, which airs originally on WEDU-TV, the PBS station in Tampa, in the Tampa Bay area. And my guest on that show, Rita Ferrandino, was the Democrat. Gal Fields was the Republican. Paula Dockery is currently an NPA, no party affiliate voter. She's a former state senator and a former state house member. And William March is an independent journalist whose work often appears in the Tampa Bay Times. We're going to try to play this interview with Dr. Martin Luther King that I want to bring to you today, but several people have commented about the TV show, And so we're going to go to Tim, who's on hold from Pinellas County, who says he's an educator and wants to comment about the TV show. Tim, you're on live. What would you like to say?
Hi. I'd just like to say that in terms of Florida, from what I've seen moving into education from an alternative career path, that the biggest thing that I've been seeing in terms of problems in Florida is a misallocation of resources, where, for instance, our testing, that seems to be one of the biggest things that is really sucking up a lot of money. And not only sucks up a lot of money, but sucks up number of school days, to where every high school course, and each subject has its own end of course exam. And every student needs to pass these end of course exams, or at least sit for them. The issue is that one of Florida's biggest things for reading success, I think it's like article number 4 or maybe 3, I forget which one, but it's specifically worded that in order to determine if our kids are successful readers, they will be have a test administered by a third-party corporate entity. Well, there's only one large corporate entity that is taking up all of those resources, and it's Pearson. Pearson, whether you're taking a computer-based test to become an EMT, whether it's to become a CNA, whether it's to be a teacher, Pearson's the one who administers all these, as well as it administers the testing to our high schoolers and younger. Well, the biggest issue then is that all these tests are what's called a norm-based test, which a norm-based test assumes that the bottom deviation of it is going to fail. So they assume about 20% failure rate on these tests. So now they're writing the test that assumes 20% failure rate, to where that's automatically putting our schools in a situation that a huge percent of our students will fail the test. They're not proficiency-based tests anymore. And it's the same for whether you want to become an educator or whether you're a high schooler just hoping to graduate so that way you can move on to the next path of your career. As a result of all of our money going towards this testing, now our class sizes have gone to be absolutely ridiculous. In the last year or two, Florida legislation changed to where it went from there being no more than 25 students in a class. Now it's become an average of 25 per school. So what happens is some teachers have classes of 10 or 15, and those are typically in the academies. And then the rest of it, which is the majority of the student body, is in classes of 40, 30. I've had classes of 43, 42, 41. And these are classes that are supposed to be heavily content driven. Well, when you put the kids who need the most resources with the least amount of resources, you're setting yourself up for failure, and you're also burning out a lot of educators, to where personally I do not know many people who are in education, whether it's from principals down to teachers, assistant principals, support staff, whether it be cooks, head plant operators, every single person unanimously is either working another job or looking for another job. I know very few people who are trying to stay in it, and it's because of all these hoops and the stripping of resources, so that way we can pay a corporate entity to administer third-party tests.
So morale is low, and so is Pearson for-profit?
Yes.
And have you looked
I believe they have several corporate umbrellas with some NPOs.
Have you looked
for profit?
Have you looked to see whether or not they give donations to people that run for governor or the legislature?
I haven't looked into that. I do know that they invest a lot of money in lobbying, though.
Do they?
Which is how they're able to get testing run right into legislation.
So they invest in lobbying here in Florida.
Correct.
Yeah. All right. So Tim, what should be done about it? What could be done about it from an educator's perspective?
I think the number one thing, like I said, is not that there's a complete lack of money. It's this gross misappropriation by sending it all. How did we allow these corporations to get involved in our education? And that's another argument against these charter schools, too. We've learned that when corporations get involved with something that is supposed to be egalitarian, that unanimously corporate greed gets in, whether it's for our environmental issues, whether it's our educational issues, roads, health. We need to have a separate entity that isn't influenced by corporations, because as much as they like to say it, corporations are not people.
Yeah.
They don't, when everybody else goes bankrupt, they don't go, the people don't go bankrupt. None of the CEOs do. They get paid bonuses before the company closes, and that money comes from other people.
Yeah. All right. Well, Tim, thanks.
So that's my 2 cents I wanted
thanks.
To say.
Thank you for taking part. Thanks for adding your perspective.
Thank you.
All right. That's Tim, who's an educator in Pinellas County, commenting about the TV show that we just heard. And this is WMNF in Tampa. Here's an email that came in during the TV show. It's anonymous. This anonymous person in the 352 area code says, it's obvious that liberals just want to destroy the Republican primaries because they're not winning elections anymore, and pretending otherwise is disingenuous. No Republican wants to vote in the Democratic primary, writes anonymous. To the point about most Floridians in a new survey support open primaries. And then 727 writes regarding education. This is another anonymous email. This person says, science education changed after Jeb Bush became governor. Environmental education was eliminated, and the FCAT ensured that it would not be taught. His term as governor was a disaster for education, writes anonymous. And thanks to B and Tim, they have just made a $120 contribution to WMNF. So B and Tim, thank you so much for making a contribution during this show. Well, today is the Martin Luther King holiday, his actual birthday, January 15th. We're going to listen back to an interview. I think sometimes the interviews are at least as interesting or maybe even more interesting than the speeches. Let's go back to November 2nd, 1967, in a really unexpected place for Dr. Martin Luther King. He was on the Mike Douglas show, which was really kind of an entertainment show. But on this show, he was asked a lot of big questions. And the questions were kind of tough. I'm not sure either Mike Douglas or Tony Martin, the singer who was on with him, really appreciated Dr. Martin Luther King. So they're going to ask him some tough questions. But listen to these answers. This goes back to a few months before Dr. Martin Luther King's assassination. So it's November 2nd, 1967. Here is, from the Mike Douglas Show, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.
Later that year, Dr. King brought his anti-war message to the Mike Douglas Show, where he defended his views against some surprisingly tough questions from the affable host and an equally unlikely adversary, singer Tony Martin. Here is Dr. King in his historic appearance, which seems remarkably relevant after 40 years.
Tony, our next guest is the winner of the Nobel Prize for Peace and perhaps the foremost spokesman for the nonviolent faction in the American Negro Civil Rights Movement. Now, his recent speeches and sermons urging Negroes not to fight in Vietnam have initiated a verbal argument among prominent Negroes that threatens to split the civil rights movement wide open. Would you please welcome a very outstanding and controversial gentleman, Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. I said to Dr. King, I want to put you right in the middle. I wasn't thinking. You've been put in the middle quite often,
right,
haven't you?
That's quite right.
Dr. King, why did you decide to urge Negroes not to fight in Vietnam?
Well, I think my view has been a little distorted at that point. I haven't only urged Negroes not to fight. I feel that the war is so unjust, so abominable, so futile and bloody and costly that nobody should be fighting there. I haven't limited my concern to just the American Negro, although I know we are dying in disproportionate numbers there, and we are on the losing end both there and at home, because as long as the war in Vietnam continues, social problems will inevitably suffer here at home.
Well, don't you think that your remarks have created doubts about the Negro's loyalty to his country?
Well, some people may feel that. I don't think our loyalty to the country should be measured by our ability to kill. I think our loyalties to the country should be measured by our ability to lead the nation to higher heights of democracy and to the great dream of justice and humanity.
Do you honestly feel, Dr. King, that the war in Vietnam could be stopped now without harm to this country?
Well, there are two ways to deal with it. One is a unilateral withdrawal. I don't oppose that because I feel that this is a possibility. After all, France withdrew unilaterally from Algeria, withdrew without a military victory. Mm-hmm. And this did not lessen France's prestige or influence in the world. If anything, it increased its prestige
in the world. But France
is
not the power that this country is.
Well, I think that's an even greater reason why we should restrain our power. There's always the danger that any nation will abuse its power. And I think our power must be much more than military power. We don't need to prove to the world or anybody our military power. I think we've got to prove our moral power.
Do you feel that this nation has abused, their power?
Oh, I certainly do in the war in Vietnam. I have no doubt about that. I'm not saying that it was done with evil motives in mind. I think we made a huge miscalculation. And when you make a mistake, you ought to confess it. One of the great things about President Kennedy was that he said to the world, to his closest advisors, that he made a mistake in the Bay of Pigs invasion in Cuba, and he said, I never should have listened to the experts. And I think the time has come now for our leaders to say that we've made a grave mistake in Vietnam, and we ought to take the initiative in bringing an end to this conflict, if not through a unilateral withdrawal, at least through a negotiated settlement. And I think there are things that we can do to create the atmosphere for negotiation.
You know, Dr. King, my first question, when you said you didn't say it was inaccurate, but you said it was a misunderstanding that you didn't advise just Negroes not to fight in Vietnam. But I think it was interpreted that way. Now, how about the heroic Negroes already in Vietnam? Don't your remarks belittle their accomplishments?
Oh, not at all. I have nothing but admiration for the bravery of those who are engaged in the kind of sacrificial and suffering situation that they are in. I'm not dealing with their particular situation in terms of fighting. I'm trying to do something, trying to lead us somewhere that will bring an end to what I see as a terrible and a very tragic war, which is damaging the image of our nation here and abroad.
Doctor, may I ask you a question?
Yes.
Don't you feel that perhaps the parents of the boys who are now currently in the operation in Vietnam might not be in amity with your civil rights movement now because of your...
I doubt that. Yes. I doubt that very seriously. I can't overestimate the amount of discontent in the Negro community over the war in Vietnam. I haven't seen any loss of support in the Negro community.
I don't mean just in the Negro community. I mean there are many, many of the Caucasians who are with your civil rights movement as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just wondering if you're not disingratiating yourself, how you feel about those who have their sons in Vietnam now.
Well, there again, I think two things are important here. First, I think that the things that I'm saying and the things that I'm trying to do and all of the people in the peace movement are trying to do are really geared toward bringing the boys back home. In other words, we are trying to prove to be their best friends by doing something to bring about the climate that will bring an end to this war. Secondly, anyone who is committed to civil rights would not withdraw that commitment as a result of someone in the civil rights movement taking a stand against the war in Vietnam. And if they do, then they were not with it in the beginning. You stand up for what is just because it is just and right. I think it was T.S. Eliot who said, there's no greater heresy than to do the right thing for the wrong reason.
That's right.
And a lot of people do the right thing for the wrong reason. And I submit that anyone who would stop supporting civil rights because of a stand against the war on the part of some leaders ended up doing the right thing for the wrong reason. They were never truly committed to civil rights in the beginning.
You're listening to an interview with Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. This took place November 2nd, 1967, just a few months before his assassination.
Truly committed to civil rights in the beginning.
Dr. King, Carl Rowan, our former ambassador to Finland, has said that your statements against Negro participation in the war have, and I quote, alienated many of the Negro's friends and armed the Negro's foes. Now, what is your comment on that statement?
Well, I'm sorry to have to disagree very vigorously with Mr. Rowan on that. I go back to the same statement that people who have been alienated as a result of this stand against the war were alienated anyway. Many people supported us in civil rights when we were in Selma or Birmingham because they were against the brutality of a Bull Connor. Jim Clark, and they were deeply outraged about these things. And they supported us because they were against that brutality, not because they were for genuine equality for the Negro. And if anybody's been alienated, it's been because they were really not absolutely committed to the ideal of genuine equality for the Negro. And any little excuse that comes along, they will use that. But the basic thing is that they were not committed anyway.
This equality for the Negro that you mentioned, how much longer are the Negro people willing to wait for this equality, which is certainly due them?
Well, the mood in the Negro community, as you know, is a mood of great disappointment and despair and even bitterness as a result of the slow pace of progress and as a result of the fact that in some instances, things have gotten worse, particularly in the economic area. And I think the impatience is very deep and the discontent is very broad. And if something isn't done with haste to remove the intolerable conditions that exist in our communities all over the nation, then I see us sinking into darker nights of social disruption.
Dr. Tony, do you believe that your remarks have put a strain on the relations of the civil rights movement? Do you believe so?
Well, not really. As I said, many people, white and Negro, are deeply opposed to the war in Vietnam. Interestingly enough, when I first spoke out against the war, only 21% of the American people were against it. Both the Gallup and the Harris polls reveal now that the majority of Americans are against the war in Vietnam. Some 48% are now opposed to the war in Vietnam. 10% remain undecided. And you have about 42% who are still in favor. So you have a majority opposed to the war in Vietnam. And I haven't seen the great opposition to my position that so many people would state. The other thing is that a man of conscience can never be a consensus leader. He doesn't take a stand in order to search for consensus. He's ultimately a molder of consensus. And I've always said that the ultimate measure of a man is not where he stands in moments of conflict and moments of convenience, but where he stands in moments of challenge and moments of controversy. And I would take this position even if I didn't have the majority of people agreeing with me now.
Using your feeling about unilateral and the way France settled, which was very well done, they didn't lose face. Apparently, face is the important thing at this time. But not only are we losing face, but it would be better to save lives. We know that.
Mm-hmm.
Who will be the GOAT if someone takes upon themselves to end this war and settle it unilaterally? Will there be a constant complaint, what a big waste this was? Will this set a precedent for the United States in the future of defending our inheritance, our independence?
Well, I think we have to look at several things here. First, in my mind, peace is much more important than face. And I think there has to be a transformation here in terms of our thinking. And in terms of peace, we've got to come to see now that peace must not only be a goal that we talk about and seek, but a means by which we arrive at that goal. The other thing is this, that even though the mood of the country may not be in line with the unilateral withdrawal now, I think there are things that can be done to bring about a negotiated settlement. Now, there are many people who have talked very closely with the leaders of North Vietnam and the National Liberation Front, who tell us if we bring about an unconditional halt in the bombings, this would get talks going. Our government has refused to do that. And I feel that since we took the initiative in escalating the war in the air and on the land and on the seas, then we have a moral obligation to take the initiative to de-escalate it, and I think we can do that by bringing about a halt to the bombings. And our security
is involved. Do you think that that would do it, by halting the bombing? Would that do it?
Well, as I said, I can only go by men like you taunt the Russian leaders, and many other people who have talked very closely with the leadership of North Vietnam and the National Liberation Front. I think we ought to try it anyway. I think we ought to bring about an unconditional halt to the bombings, and we should do that for practical reasons in terms of trying to get talks started, and I think we should do it for moral reasons. They are never going to negotiate as long as we're bombing that territory.
How about your relationship with President Johnson? Have you lost favor with Mr. Johnson?
Well, I guess the president would have to answer that question. I have taken a position against the administration's policy, and I would hope that the president means what he says when he says that there should always be room for dissent. And we come to a tragic period in our nation when we equate dissent with disloyalty. I believe firmly that it is necessary to have these moments of dissent in order to challenge something that may be leading the whole nation down the wrong path.
Do you care if you have lost favor with Mr. Johnson?
Well, that isn't, I guess, the most important thing to me. The important thing is that I not lose favor with truth and with what conscience tells me is right and what conscience tells me is just. I'm much more concerned about keeping favor with these principles than keeping favor with a person who may misunderstand the position I take.
We will talk further with Dr. Martin Luther King following these messages. We'll be right back.
You're listening to an interview with Dr. Martin Luther King from November 1967. This is WMNF in Tampa, 88.5 FM. Here's more of that interview.
Dr. King, if I may, I found this in this morning's paper. Negroes hail results of Dr. King's policy. Berkeley, California, more than 4 out of 5 American Negroes believe the nonviolence of Dr. Martin Luther King has done the most to help their race, a study reveals. But about half of the same Negroes interviewed for a University of California study believe riots have done some good. Findings, which include interviews with 1,119 Negroes, were released in a book titled Protest and Prejudice. Author Gary T. Marks, now assistant sociology professor at Harvard University, reports the majority of Negroes seem to direct their hatred and anger toward the system of evil and those who support it, not indiscriminately against all whites. Can you comment on that article?
Yes, I'm very interested in hearing that. I hadn't read the article, and I hadn't read the book. In fact, I wasn't aware of it. But I think it is true that the vast majority of Negroes feel that the best way to resolve the problem is to work through peaceful, nonviolent means and militant nonviolence, but not through violence. Now, on the question of whether riots have helped, I've taken the position that riots are socially destructive and self-defeating, and therefore I have to take a stand against it because of my deep commitment to nonviolence. On the other hand, I do think a riot is the language of the unheard, and America has failed to hear, for instance, that the plight of the Negro poor has worsened over the last 10 or 15 years. I think it has also failed to hear that large segments of white society are more committed to tranquility and the status quo than to justice and humanity and equality. And in that sense, I think the riots have called attention to something. Not that they had brought about social transformation, but they called attention to a very serious problem in our society. But I couldn't say that they have been helpful in the sense of really bringing about structural change. I haven't seen any basic change that has come through riots. The changes that we have made and the changes that we've seen over the last 10 or 12 years have come through powerful watershed nonviolent movements.
Dr. Martin Luther King, November 2nd, 1967, just a few months before his assassination on the Mike Douglas Show. If you want to get a link to that series of interviews, you can email me here in the studio at dj@wmnf.org. Happy Martin Luther King Day holiday. This is WMNF in Tampa. Stay tuned for the latest news. And then right after that, we'll hear an episode of The Jimmy Dore Show.